The wafting breeze of Dhamma on a hot day cools the heart. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Very good. So this is actually, joking aside, the last talk of this Rains Retreat. So we have our Pool Avenue Day on Tuesday. So please, all monks, it's Tuesday at 5:30. 5:30. So please tell Venerable Chaga that, 5:30 p.m. Not 5:30 a.m., not 5:35. 5:30 for Pool Avenue Day. So there was actually a suggestion for a talk from the Jhana Groovies. To talk on the subject of unshakable faith or confidence, which is usually said of the stream winner, but what it actually means and how it occurs is a really nice thing to talk about, because until that faith is unshakable, it means that one doesn't really know what to believe in or where to really go, even though that you may have a lot of inspiration from this path, that sometimes it's not really enough. And of course, in the marketplace of ideas and views and religious theories, there's just so much to go on. And so it's always a very tough thing, this idea of a faith, which one you have faith in. And of course, you can't really have faith in a teacher. Too often people have had faith in the teachers and they have come to grief afterwards. And I say that as a popular teacher with many disciples. And my first statement is, you never ever take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Ajahn this or Sayod or that. You always take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, not in a person. And that's a very important point there, because it is the nature of human beings actually to have faith in a being, in a person, rather than in something which is transcends the person, like the Sangha, this huge movement of people through the ages. And when I was just talking to someone the other day about nice places actually to go as monks on retreat, you know, talking about Sri Lanka and the experience, you know, the first time I was there when I wasn't famous, I can come and go easily. And I went to this forest monastery just outside of Anuradhapura somewhere, and I stayed there the night in a cave hut, you know, which was above the door, was inscribed, I think, built in the 3rd century of the common era. It was 1800 years old, this cave, and you can prove it because it had the inscription in there. And it was incredible to actually to spend a night and meditate in a place where people had been meditating, the Sangha had been continuing for a huge length of time. That was incredibly inspiring for me. And sort of, now it's those inspirations which actually increase the faith, but doesn't make it solid. Because, you know, sometimes that, you know, you get the inspiration in Sangha and its continuity for so many, many, many centuries. And sometimes people get inspiration in the Dhamma, but you just have to look through all the different books and the talks and monks arguing about what's the right Dhamma, what's the wrong Dhamma. And that's very, very difficult. It's one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah would actually say, if I get this right, I forget now exactly, he said, for the first 5 years as a monk, your knowledge of Dhamma after 5 years is zero. After 10 years, I think it's 5%. He said something like that, really put the monks down in their place. Just thinking that, you know, you've been a monk for such a long time, you must know the Dhamma. He said, no, just the years you spend is not really the point. And this is one of the reasons why it's hard to know who to believe. So in order to get a faith which is certain and unshakable, It has to be based on some sort of experience. You just can't do it because it feels right or it sounds right. Or the monk seems to have lots of disciples. Or the monk, he wears his robe so beautifully. Or the monk, he's a vegetarian. Or whatever it is which people get inspired in. I'm really stuffed now because one of our very early supporters, it was a dentist's wife, she told me, unfortunately I was okay at that time, it was many years ago, she said, I can never have faith in a fat monk. Fortunately, she passed away a long time ago. But you can see just people have all these assumptions, you know, what a monk, what a nun should look like. And so having faith in that, that doesn't really, really have any hope for you at all. And so sometimes some people actually see enlightened monks and they miss them. So there was this one monk I remember just visiting when I was a young monk in Thailand. Actually, I had already come to Australia. I was visiting Thailand at the time and just visiting a few places. And this monk lived in quite a well-known forest monastery. If you know that story, because we were talking about it the other day, that one of the monks a long time ago, he was meditating in the hut in the jungle, and you know, the hut was just, you know, wooden posts and just bamboo and thatch, and it was on an elephant trail. And so when the elephant came by and saw there was a hut right in the middle of his path, elephants are just pretty arrogant. Instead of going round it, you know, which, you know, most people would do, or most respectful elephants would do, this elephant, he just, you know, wrapped his trunk around one of the posts and just pulled it out of the way. And there happened to be a monk in there at the time. He said he was scared so much, you know, just being dragged. You know, imagine you're in your hut and it's being dragged along the ground by something. You know, it'd be pretty scary. And that was, you know, they showed me the hut or the place where the hut used to be, you know, in this monastery. There was a monk there. And this particular monk, he was just an ordinary looking monk, as far as most people knew. But, you know, some of the forest monks say you should actually, you know, listen to this monk. He's really, really something. And it was an old monk. You would never expect, you know, to have, you know, all these great attainments and even even powers. And I remember one of the monks telling me that it's actually old Ajahnyana, and he was talking to him sometime after I visited, and starting to tell that, you know, he says, "Where do you live?" He says, "Australia." I said, "Where's that?" "It's down south." And he said, "What happens if you go further down south? You get to Antarctic, you know, and that's about as far as you can go south." And that's what he said. And the following morning, this monk said, "Yeah, you know, what he said is quite correct. If you go past Australia, there's lots of ice down there." So the guy who's saying this matter-of-factly, you know, he just, you know, the night before, just to check, see if Ajahnyana Dhamma knew what he was talking about, actually, you know, did some astral travel, mind made body, and just went down to see the ice in Antarctica. So it's really cold down there. And just the way he said it, you know, was information which hadn't been given to him, which was accurate, which showed that he could do these things. There was one case, you know, of one monk who no one would have known, you know, was sort of a great monk. And apparently his story was, again, interesting little story of old monks, that he just happened to be in the town of Sakonakon in the north of Thailand, northeast of Thailand, just doing some business. And it was the occasion of Ajahn Mun's funeral. And he just popped in just to see, and he heard a Dhamma talk and inspired him so much that he renounced and left the world, became a monk. And all he really heard was sit a lot, walk a lot. That's it. So he ordained, and that's all he ever did, was just walk, meditation, sit, meditation. And he was, you know, being these tough northeastern farmers, you know, when he got tired on his walking path, he'd just sit right there in the middle of his walking path. And when he finished his meditation, he'd get up and start walking again, walking meditation. And that's all he did all day for months. So no wonder, you know, he got something. But the thing was, the purpose of me telling that story, you just cannot tell the person. So if you're going to have unshakable faith, please never have unshakable faith in any monk or any nun, me included, because that's not taking refuge in the right person, right things. You take refuge in the Sangha, in the Dhamma, in just what the teachings, not the person giving those teachings. And the only person you can take refuge in is the Buddha. But of course, people don't know who the Buddha was until you get some really powerful insights. So, taking refuge, you know, in the Dhamma. Crikey. What Dhamma are you going to take refuge in? Because again, many people say many different things. And you will notice that they all are so sure that they are right. And this is one of the problems with people. And sometimes we go on a person's confidence. Wow, they are so confident they are right. They must be right. And you know, you always have to bring up the Christian pastors in there. They are so confident they are right that they get lots and lots of followers. And you know, you don't need to be a nuclear physicist to know that, you know, what they say is a lot of gomayang. But they're very confident. So confidence and having a lot of disciples is no way to have faith in that teaching. And even when you look in the suttas, I thought, oh, look in the suttas and you find out what's right and what's wrong. But even in the suttas, there's so many people just argue, you know, about what the suttas say. Just one example is just, you know, things like in the jhanas. So is there any thought in the jhanas? You know, can you actually hear anything in the jhanas? Even though that, you know, I look at that Pali and I know Pali good enough and you compare it with other things. And to me, it's all obvious, even the suttas say that. But that doesn't stop people from believing other stuff, which is a problem with faith. It's a bit dangerous to have faith. And that's why in the Buddhist tradition, you know, we don't really encourage it that much. We encourage questioning, being able to ask questions and being encouraged to ask questions, never being put off and criticized because you ask too many questions. You know, you're supposed to ask questions, to investigate, to challenge. But even that is not good enough. I often wonder just, how can you trust, you know, what you believe is true? And in the end, you know, it's what I read in the suttas and what I practice and what, you know, finally makes sense. Is, you know, the story or the thing running through the whole of our practice, five hindrances, the Pajjanivarana, they are what stop wisdom. They hinder wisdom. They block it. That's why it's called a hindrance, an obstruction. And, you know, just contemplating them for the last 41 years and just seeing just, you know, how they bend the truth to fit what you want to believe. And that answered a lot of questions for me. How come people, you know, believe in this rubbish? It's because they want to. And how come they can't see the truth? Because that is far too challenging for them. They have to sacrifice too much. They don't want to see what is real. And of all of those hindrances, you can see that those stop you penetrating the truth. And many of those, that desire and that ill will, that is coming from your faith. Because you have faith in something, you trust that you want it to be true, it means you only see things which conform and confirm your beliefs. And just what you can't take, you just don't see. Just like that simile, you know, which I've been talking about way too much already, about Bernard's talk about the experiment in the Imperial College of levitating the flower pot. They levitated it. It was only a trick, but you know, they saw it happen. And the people who could not take that because it challenged their views of science too much, they literally could not see it. It's a great experiment to see just how people with eyes, with a rational mind, well-trained as scientific observers, they just literally could not see what was in front of them because their views were challenged too much. And that was a very brilliant example of just what we're faced with in trying to get unshakable faith in what is real and true, and not unshakable faith in what is untrue. Because that faith in what is untrue, that can stay solid for years and years and years, even lifetimes. That's why one has been reborn so many times. But to get the real unshakable faith in the Dhamma, which, you know, is the stream winner, which is going to lead you to Nibbana, that is something totally different than the other unshakable faiths. And so when one can appreciate it, it's the hindrances which stop one seeing things clearly. Obviously, I always say restlessness and sloth and torpor. It's so obviously restlessness. You don't have stayed long enough with any one thing to really understand it. You're always moving on to the next stuff. And sloth and torpor, you're just too dull to understand anything at all. It's just you're in a mist, you're in a cloud of unknowing. It's not a good thing. It is just dullness. So you do need those, especially those first four hindrances, to be overcome, to be able to get wisdom, to see things as they truly are. And of course, you know, that I've made a lot over the last few months of saying that, you know, it's not an easy thing to see the truth. You have to go across fear. And our barrier of fear is always a great sign you're getting somewhere in your practice of understanding the truth of things. The truth is very scary because you have to give up a lot of what you believed before. And sometimes it's a lot of attachments, a lot of your ego, your sense of self and who you are and what you want in life. It just, me and mine have to be abandoned. And you know that what happens when you meditate, that even the body starts to vanish, and that's scary. There's incredible lights come up in the mind, and that's scary. And you're about to let go of your will, and that's scary. The whole path is a very scary path. And that's why a lot of people, I just have to keep on encouraging them, please just let go, carry on, you're going to be free. And it's the old simile of when a person has been in prison for 10, 20, 30 years, they don't want to be released into the free world. They're scared because they've got used to being in prison. And that's the best simile we have. You've been in prison for lifetimes. Now the doors of the jail are open, are you going to go through? That takes a lot of courage. It's not just faith anymore, but courage. If you really want to get to something like stream winning, you have to be so committed to finding the truth. You're almost willing to give up your whole life for this. I mean, literally willing to die for it. And that's why Ajahn Chah used to say to us when we first came to Wat Pa Phong, he said, have you come here to die? And he meant that in so many different ways, you know, to die to your past, to die to your ego, to die to your body even, to be able to let go that much. Are you willing to do that? Because it is a scary path if you want to find the truth. But you know, comes a time with many of us, we've become so weary, you know, of the old ways of doing things, weary of the world, weary of just, you know, getting stuff and then losing it, and just sure there must be an escape, you know, from this weariness of life. I'm not saying old age, sickness and death, we all know about that, but just the weariness of it all. Getting up in the morning, another breakfast, another lunch, another washing up, another just going out, another building to do, another talk to give. You know, there's a sort of a weariness about life. And after a while, you know, that should actually give you some courage. Let's go for this. Let's actually go through my fears and see what happens when I do really let go, when things vanish and disappear. Because otherwise, without that fear, you will never actually abandon those hindrances. Without going through that fear. So the fear is a sign that things are being abandoned. And the other side of that, and every time I've done that, and the other side of that fear is just so much peace and freedom and joy. You go through that a couple of times, you soon get the insight that every time this fear, it's a stupid thing to just to run away from it. It's, you know, ridiculous to stop. Don't react to the fear, go through it. And you do that a few times and you get the hang of it, that if I can just sit here and just let the fear come, it doesn't really matter, it's not going to hurt me, and anyway, I've come here to die, you know, the search for the truth is the most important thing in my life, I'm going to really commit to it. So when this fear, this terror sometimes come up, things are starting to vanish, you go to places you've never been to before, am I going to go mad? Of course you don't, there's no one there to go mad. You know, you just get enlightened maybe. But certainly you go into some very beautiful places. And you do this a few times, and you realize that when I don't react to the fear, when I go through it, it's always beautiful and beneficial. You do it once, do it twice, and after a while the fear just is regarded as just a stage. It's nothing which is challenging you anymore. It's nothing which controls you anymore. It's just part of the path. You just go through it. Finish, that's it. And so that means that you are overcoming the fear, which is one of the big obstacles to actually letting go. And what you're letting go of, every time you have to let go, it's actually challenging. You know, your hindrances. It's like the hindrances, just like the people go to school, they do grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, and every year they get a test. If they pass, they can go on to the next grade. It's just like every part of meditation, you're tested. And if you can let go and go through that fear, let go of another thing, then you can go to the next stage and you get a higher test, and then a higher test, and a higher test. And you get really, really deep. You have to pass all these tests in letting go, in how much you can disappear, how much you can be unafraid, how much you can be committed to that truth, to realization, how much, you know, you can just be here instead of trying to go places and do things. It's a test of stillness and letting go, renunciation, kindness. And every stage is another test. And when you pass it, you go through to the next stage, the next stage. And every stage you are weakening these hindrances, testing them. That's why, you know, it's very easy, talking about this to the Jhana Gurus as well, when you do a 9-day retreat, it's easy to get some nice meditation. It's only 9 days, because, you know, the mind knows, okay, I can give you 9 days, because afterwards I'll be back to my usual stuff. You're not really giving up stuff. You're just putting it aside for a while. Then you do your 3-month retreats, those people who've been in Jhana Grove for 3 months. It's a different ball game. You have to renounce much more. But again, it's not real renouncing, because many of you are going to go back in the next week or two to your old lives. It's not real renouncing. Real renouncing is scary. You really are giving up everything. So the Sangha life. And to be able to do that, that means that you are weakening your hindrances. One of the differences between real Sangha life and the lay world is in the lay world you're in control of your life. Here you've got very little control. And you'll find the more senior you get, the less control you have. That's what it's like being Ajahn Brahm. I have so little control over my life. Even the bed I sleep in, someone put it in there. And once, you know, Lee and David come here, I don't know what's left in my cave after they've been here, because they take things out to auction. I don't even control my own bedroom I don't control. Next week we're going to have Katina Day, and it's a couple of weeks' time, and all these people going into my bedroom. And I remember once I was just the Katina. That actually was here. Oh, was it here? Yeah, I think it was still having it here. It was a lot of people here. And after the Katina day, talking to people, doing all these ceremonies, about 2 or 3 o'clock, when I could finally get back for a rest, you know, I was just really exhausted. And so I went back just around the corner, opened the door of my cave, and there's someone sitting in it. I said, get out, this is my cave. But it's Katina day, we were allowed to, no, you're not, get out of here. I always remember that. Oh, that was pretty mean, but I think I deserve to be mean. Get out. So that's some little eye control of my life. But that's actually really good, because you are really letting go of a huge amount. And it's tough to do. But scary, but really beautiful when you start to do it. Because once you're doing that letting go, yeah, you know, it's just, basically, it's much more fun not to have make decisions. Let the Sangha make the decisions for you. If you have to make decisions, you're the controller, then, well, you always get a lot of criticism back. Now, I just say, well, the Sangha told me to do it. So I pass the buck to you guys, okay? So it's your fault. I take no responsibility. Praise, yes, I always accept the praise. But fault, I always pass it on to somebody else. So anyway, trying to get some faith and understanding. Because you do get to some stage where those hindrances are totally gone. There is no desire left. There is no ill will. There's no restlessness. You're not doing anything anymore. You're literally still. Because once there's a desire, there's a movement of the mind. And if you're going to overcome that desire, it has to be movement-less. Even ill will moves the mind. That's why I always call like third and fourth hindrances like secondary. The main hindrances are the first two. Third and fourth are secondary hindrances, because the restlessness comes from desire and ill will. And the sloth and torpor, just the tiredness, comes from having so much restlessness for such a long time, your poor brain is just tired. So the first two are the big ones. So once those are given up, you know they're given up, because the second two disappear as well. So it's that when the first two are given up, the third and fourth disappear as well. Because you don't have any desire, no place to go, nothing you want, nothing you deny, nothing you're trying to get rid of. Of course you become still. This is why that keep on talking about this. You know, you can't use the hindrances to get rid of the hindrances. You can't desire to get rid of desire. You can't have ill will to your hindrances. That's just creating more hindrances. So what you actually do, you cut them off by being still, by letting go, doing nothing, opening the door of your heart to this moment, making peace, being kind, being gentle. It doesn't take a great brain to realize that the hindrances are the problem, and you don't sort of, you know, solve the hindrances with more hindrances by encouraging them. You do the opposite. The letting go, the kindness, the stillness, not wanting anything. And when you start practicing that way, you know, you understand that this is a path. And you know it's a path because the hindrances start to vanish, and so do a lot of other stuff start to vanish. And as the hindrances start to vanish, of course, you know, this mindfulness starts to increase. That's the sign that the hindrances are disappearing. Your mindfulness gets strong. And it doesn't mean your mindfulness can see this and see that. The very quality and the strength of your mindfulness totally changes. And you don't, it's obvious, you know, there are times in this day you're really aware, there's times when you're really dull. There are times in this day when you wake up in the morning and you don't know what you're doing. And there's times in the day you're just so clear. And you all have those experiences, the different levels of mindfulness, of awareness. And of course, the more the hindrances are there, the more dull that mindfulness is. The more the hindrances have vanished, the more they're subdued, the stronger that mindfulness is. And of course, that mindfulness has to be incredibly strong. That is a sign that the hindrances are really, really subdued. They're, you know, getting very, very weak. The strength of your mind. So that is where you can actually just look at a brick and see so much. You look at the leaf on a tree and there's this incredible amount of stuff going on in there. That is a sign your mindfulness is increasing. And of course, the other sign is you have much more joy and happiness. That is also the sign of strong mindfulness, a sign the hindrances which cause suffering are being reduced. So if you really want to get this unshakable faith, you know, you have to meditate, subduing hindrances, going through fear, going the other side, not sort of reacting to it, just going right through there, doesn't matter what's going to happen. You know, you're willing to sacrifice everything, your body, your mind, the whole lot for this Dhamma. So you just keep nothing back. What was the Buddha simile? Like the royal elephant. So the real royal elephant goes into battle, doesn't try and protect its trunk and its ears and its leg and its back and its shoulders. Will sacrifice everything for the king. He said, that is a real royal elephant. It's a pretty violent simile, but it just shows just how much sacrifice is necessary if you really want to get unshakable faith. You really need to give up everything, you know, to find out this Dhamma. And after a while, you know, you just get so fed up with life, with weariness, old age, sickness and death, coming and going, going to this place and that place. After a while, you say, right, this is it. I'm going to just go for this, no matter what. If it drives me crazy, if I end up in a mental hospital, if I end up in and it's not just sitting, just may my blood dry up. That's effort. This is wisdom power. You're not going to give in to the defilements. You're not going to give in to fear. You're just going to go for it. Go right through. See things vanish. Let them vanish. And watch as your mindfulness starts to increase. And it's a fantastic thing when your mindfulness increases. Then you see the really real defilements. Those five hindrances, yeah, you know, they're the problem. But they're refined form people just don't see. That's why even that first hindrance, you know, the desire for the five sense world. I just mentioned desire first of all. That's the coarse form of that hindrance. But the real part of that hindrance is when your body and senses are about to vanish and you won't let them. That shows that you still have that craving, that desire for five senses and the body. That is why you can't let them go. Because that hindrance is still there. You are still attached to the five sense world. And it's, you know, it's something you can notice. That's why you have a barrier there to get into the jhanas. So you have to let that go. And that's a very refined part. The more refined part of the ill will is, I don't want to be in this stage, I want to be in the next stage. Your ill will to this moment. And of course that stops you. And you find out that these hindrances are incredibly refined. But you need incredibly strong mindfulness to see the incredibly refined form of the hindrances. So that's why this is a brilliant, beautiful path. You let go a little, your mindfulness is increased, you can see the hindrances more, so you can let go more. The mindfulness increases even more, so you can let go more as you see the more refined parts, and then you let go more. And it's almost like a dance of mindfulness and letting go as you progress. And what I'm describing is just what meditation is. That's what meditation is. You just let go and get into more refined, hindrance-less, not totally free yet, but hindrance-reduced states of mind. And you know that because it is powerful mindfulness and very joyful. So those of you who have doubt about the path, you know you're on the right way because hindrances are lessening. You know that because mindfulness is increasing. You're much more aware. You know that because you have more joy. It's great ways, great signs of knowing that you're on the right path. And as you go more and more deep, if the hindrances are totally abandoned, then literally there's nothing between you and the jhanas. The door is wide open. And for me, just, it's so obvious. If the door's open, you go through. You're not going to just say, okay, got far enough now. Now I'm going to contemplate Dhamma. It's ridiculous. And it's a way that you know that you've got that far. Confirm the hindrances are overcome by entering the jhanas. Powerful, blissful states of mind. And I think I mentioned this, I think I was in a sutta class. Sometimes, this jury's still out in my mind, but it does seem that some of these Christian monks did actually get into a first jhana state. And the reason I say that is because that they used a path of surrender. Surrender to a higher being, which is basically letting go of themselves, letting go of their own will, especially. So I can see that, I can see how that would work. You're letting go of your own will because you believe in some higher being, which means that you do surrender, sacrifice. And what you're sacrificing and surrendering is your ego, yourself, your wanting, which means you can be still. And it's interesting to say that those people who did, have those experiences, it was like not just an ordinary experience. This was like, what they called a union with God, ultimate bliss, pure love. Now, I only mention that because sometimes these days people call jhanas, I got in first jhana today. And you look at them, that's not first jhana. Is that like union with God? Are you now a saint? Are you blissed out, your whole head has exploded in bliss and everything else? These are huge states. And please don't demean them. These are Uttari Manusa Dhamma in the Pali. States of, superior, beyond ordinary human experience. These are very, very refined. And they're available to everyone here. You can do it. But they're huge. So actually, when these things actually happen, so then you know the hindrances have been abandoned. And when you come out afterwards, after the experience, then the hindrances are gone for a long time. That's one of the reasons why when people get into those jhana states, they think they're enlightened. And the reason is because the hindrances are gone for a long time. You can't see any desire. You can't see any ill will. Nothing irritates you. You've got perfectly clear mind. No sloth and torpor. It's really hard to sleep. If you want to sleep, you just usually lay down, perfectly mindful. And you wake, don't wake up, you just rise when your body's rested. That's what sometimes it's like. When you've had a really great meditation, hindrances are gone for a while. But that's only one of the causes for seeing the Dhamma. The hindrances are gone. And then the only reason I keep on saying why the difference between, say, a Christian priest who has had that experience and a Buddhist who's had that experience is the Buddhist has also heard some of these teachings of an Aryan, someone who's seen the Dhamma themselves. And things like non-self. No one there. Just we talked about, we just chanted the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. All sankhara, including will, is not me, not mine, not a self. All consciousness, all types of consciousness, is not me, not mine, not a self. We just did that chant in Pali. But we translate it into English, and you've all read that or heard that in the classes. So at least you've heard how the Buddha describes things. And you combine that with the experience, after jhana. And suddenly, when those two come together, that's actually when you actually really penetrate what the Buddha actually saw. You do need both. To actually to get the stream winning experience. the words of another, and also the jhana experience, free from the hindrances. And these days, people have read so much, and sometimes you get confused. So at least in this monastery, we try and keep to the suttas, the word of the Buddha, as much as we possibly can. And you can see what the Buddha actually taught. It's, you know, suffering, dukkha, you know, everything. You can't actually try and reserve what I call an ultimate retirement home somewhere. Some little bit, some little place where you can exist and not suffer. So all bhava, the Buddha said, is like having a piece of shit on your finger, even a tiny bit, stinks. All being, all existence, all type of stuff is like that. Buddha teaches that, but most monks don't believe that. They have all these other silly ideas of what nibbana is. But once you've actually overcome the hindrances, and you've actually heard and read the suttas, not your teacher, not, you know, what this Ajahn said or what that Sayadaw said, but, you know, see what the Buddha actually taught, clear, precise, those two come together, and then something happens. All of that paradigm, your worldview, the way of looking at things, the sort of ideas which stops really intelligent scientists from seeing a flower pot rise on the table. What blocks you from seeing the Dhamma is removed. You have the opportunity. Buddha's teachings are there, hindrances are gone. So now you can actually see those teachings as the Buddha saw them. That is where this enlightenment experience is happening. You need the teachings, clear, simple, of a Buddha. Sometimes they say the teachings of someone who's Aryan. But there's so many people go out these days claiming they're Aryans, you know, it's pretty confusing. So at least you know the Buddha was one of the Aryans, almost by definition. So follow those Buddha's teachings. You've got his teachings, and you've got hindrances overcome. That is your job. If you want to get enlightened, if you want to be a stream winner, if you want to actually end this weariness of having to come and listen to Dhamma talks week after week, giving Dhamma talks week after week, same old, another katina. This is my 41st katina. All these people coming to ask you questions after lunch when it's hot, your belly is full, you just want to go and have a rest, and you also want to go to the toilet too. I'm getting old now. So, okay, I need to go to the toilet more often. So, sometimes you're sitting up there, you've been up there since about 20 past 10, and it's now more 20 past 12, and another person comes up, oh, I jump up, can I just ask you a question? And if I just get a bit sort of, you know, can you just give me a break? So, you can understand what's going on. It's weary being a monk, being a human being, being alive, being in samsara. So the only way to overcome that weariness is to get out. This is the way to get out. Because once you see the Dhamma, and I mean you've had jhana, you've got hindrances are gone, totally gone, and you've heard the teaching of the Buddha, you've read it, you've heard it, those two come together. It's what I described in my book, like the match and the gunpowder. Bang. And the experience of being a stream winner is an experience, a moment, an explosion. That's why, like I've said this before, it's in the book, that's why I was interested, and Ajahn Pamali would know this, in the commentaries. You know, we got this rule, fourth parajika first of all, that you not allowed, you know, not say allowed, but if a monk lies about such attainments as being a stream winner or not being a stream winner, they go and tell other people, they say, I'm a stream winner. And then if you're lying about that deliberately, that's parajika. That means you have to leave the monkhood or the sisterhood, if you're a nunhood, whatever you call it, if you're a bhikkhuni, it's an important rule. So in the commentary they said, well, you know, if there's an accusation that a monk has made this claim and he admits he's made this claim, how do you find out if it's true or not? So they have this questionnaire, which I remember reading, the Samantabhisadika, when I was studying the Vinaya. What should you do if Ajahn Appi claims that he's attained? Then you have to ask him a question. And two of the questions are, when did that happen and where? And it's an event when these things occur. And not only that, but afterwards there was consequences to these. And those consequences of being a stream wind, you can actually see that in the Ratana Sutta. I was chanting that for years until somebody pointed out that this is describing what a stream winner is. Now, Yatinda Kilo, Patawing Sitosiya, Chatubi Watebia Sampakampio. It's just that this is like this indakila, which they said was these little posts they'd stick into the ground. Now, stone columns. They said they're immovable by the four winds. They don't shake at all. That's like the stream winner. You know, like his understanding of the Dhamma is just so firm, it cannot be shaken. It's one of the reasons why, you know, somebody said when Ajahn Chakra disrobed, he said, well, he couldn't have been a stream winner then. And it's interesting. People who disrobe cannot be stream winners. The reason is because they're not solid. They haven't got that solid foundation, not stuck in the ground of the Dhamma so much that nothing will ever move them. Because this is something which has been seen and experienced when there's been nothing to bend the truth to suit themselves or to suit anything. A new, fresh understanding based on the hindrances disappearing. Something which is real. People live in fantasies because they live in the world they want to live in, or they deny stuff. But reality is when you see things as they truly are because the hindrances aren't bending the truth anymore. It's real. And that has huge consequences. One of those consequences is never again will one think that a self exists anywhere, in any form, an essence. Yang kinchi samudaya dhammang, everything which is caused, like consciousness, like mind, like will, like vedana, feeling, all of this stuff, it comes from causes. All of that, yang kinchi samudaya dhammang, sabantang, all of that will cease. Nirodha ceasing means it goes, finishes, poof, doesn't come up again. And, you know, you might read that, but when you get your head around that, even just contemplating it, even the hindrances aren't totally gone yet, but just, that's a powerful thing. And that's actually what distinguishes the Buddha's teachings from all the others. Consciousness, mind, finishes. It doesn't go to a heaven realm. That's the other teachings. Go to heaven realm, union with Brahma, just merges with cosmic consciousness. That's just other forms of heaven worship. You know, the ultimate retirement home, as I call it, of you. But Buddha would say, no, it finishes, it stops. That's really powerful. I love that teaching. And I was talking about this to someone the other day. They said, but, you can't destroy stuff. That's basic law of science. Law of the conservation of mass energy. Things can't be created or destroyed. And this is one of the problems with people because, you know, there's this process here. How can it be destroyed? How can it stop? Because it is. And I was telling people of because I love science still, and I was doing a lecture once with, what's his name? David Blair. He was a professor of physics at UWA, And in the middle of the talk, we're talking about, you know, even consciousness finishing and the end of the universe, all this really, really interesting stuff. And I remember sort of saying, well, there is something in science, in physics, and that you all know this, this part of it, called negative energy. This is not sort of, you know, psychological negative energy, but real negative energy. And then one example of that is what, you know, you remember from your science days as potential energy. When you've got a massive object in a gravitational field, it takes a lot of energy to actually to remove it from that gravitational field. That's why you need to have this huge explosion on the bottom of a spacecraft to send it into orbit. So like the spacecraft, when it's down on Earth, it's got a negative energy component. You have to use up that energy to actually get it to escape, to be free. So I asked Professor Blair, I said, what would happen if all the negative energy component of stuff in this universe totally balanced the positive energy, you know, the mass, the, you know, the other type of energy? Well, it were totally balanced, so they totally cancelled out. So this universe could come from nothing and could end in nothing. The whole universe, mass energy, could parinibbana, because the sum total is always zero. And I remember him looking at me, his jaw dropping. He said, Ajahn Brahm, you're so up to date. Omega equals one. I was very proud of that moment. But it's true. I mean, this was, you know, a well-informed physicist saying that basically all this mass, energy, stuff, Dhammasara, Bodhinyana, all these planets, the universe, if it could all come together, it would just poof. It all balance out and go to nothing. Nothing left. Not even a bang, not even a whimper. Just finished. It's like, yeah, just like the human mind. Like all the five khandhas. When it all comes together still, it stops, finishes. Nothing left. Parinibbana. And to me, that's very beautiful. For other people, that's scary. But, you know, that's one of the things which, you know, you'll see. That's what the Buddha kept on saying. Nothing left. Parinibbana. That's why they call it, not Saripari. Well, Saparisesa Nibbana. Is it Ajahn Bhamali? My brain has stopped. Aparisesa Nibbana. Oh, come on, your brain is supposed to be working. Okay, Aparisesa Nibbana, which literally means Nibbana, cessation with nothing remaining. Aparisesa. Huh? Aparisesa. No, that's not without any Upadis left. It's Aparisesa. So anyway, the English translation is without anything remaining. That's what it actually says. It's an incredible thing. Nothing left. Nothing to hang on to. It's a total letting go. So you've got nothing remaining at all. Now that's really incredible. That's wonderful. That's beautiful. So that is seeing no self. And that's actually one way you can tell who's a stream winner and who's not a stream winner. All right, not way you can tell who's a stream winner. It's one way you can tell who's not. When they still have some idea there's a self there somewhere. Some little bit of existence left. Some place where they can retire to after they've attained. And of course, you know, that's ridiculous. So these are things which really can hit you hard. Now you can believe that. That's why sometimes I think I shouldn't tell you these things, because then you just believe it. But you really want to see it for yourself. And to see it for yourself is an event, a huge event. Often what happens is those events, like the similar explosion for months, years sometimes, you think you've got something. And then what happens is when the dust of the explosion settles, you see there's still defilements remaining. You still just, you know, haven't got that total confidence yet. But when it does really go, you see those three fetters at least, stream winning. Sorry, that's not a fetter. The self-view, any doubt in this teaching, and the idea that you can get to this state, you know, just by doing practices. It does need the Eightfold Path, including the jhanas. And when that happens, and people argue, oh, do you need the jhanas, do you not need the jhanas? That's Putujana's arguing. So just do it. That's what the Buddha said, praising the jhanas. Just do those jhanas and see for yourself. And if after you've done the jhanas, become a stream winner, then you say they're not necessary. Fair enough. Although you won't. And so this is actually where you actually see what's actually happening here. An incredibly powerful experience. And what usually happens is then you go back to all these other teachings of the Buddha, and just your appreciation of them just goes up a thousandfold. Not just the accuracy of those teachings, you know, the accuracy of his descriptions of the Eightfold Path, how important they were, but just the skill with which he could teach. That's sometimes unexpected. I was just telling some of the jhana groovies that, you know, you go into some of these very deep states of mind and they're very, very hard. You know, sometimes, you know, you guys and girls, you come and say your meditation experiences, and it's just, I can see you struggling to try and describe them to me. Because, you know, these are stuff of the mind. We don't have the language for this mental world. You know, the Western world, even the Asian world these days, is all language about the five sense world, about stuff and things. But to go into this mental world, especially the deep mental world of nimittas and jhanas, just the language is so hard to find. And that's why when sort of you start, you have some experience of these things and you go back and see how the Buddha described them, you know, just it's your appreciation of the Buddha as a teacher. Not just a Buddha who was enlightened, but the way he could actually express these incredibly difficult subjects to express. You know, he had a way with words, a way to describe them. And sometimes that also gives you confidence that he really knew what he was talking about. And this starts to increase, you know, your faith in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha, simply because you've been there, you've seen it. Which means that, you know, that there's a lot of the other stupid stuff, you know, you're way past that. But be careful, though, because once you do have that unshakable faith, it's so obvious to you, you know, you tend to want to go and explain it to everybody else. And you become a pain in the ass to people when you just become a stream winner. They're not ready to hear it yet. It's just too challenging. So don't be an evangelist and go and teach everybody else. You know, it's obvious, it's, you know, understandable. You just got the biggest thing in the whole world. You want to share it with other people. But you find out a lot of other people do get jealous. And that's why it's actually Chi Kuang's teacher once told her, said, if ever you get enlightened, don't tell anybody. Otherwise you'll spend the rest of your life having to prove it. It's a very beautiful saying. Because unfortunately, that very few people have mudita. They don't sort of, you know, they don't get joy in, you know, your achievements. Mostly they get jealousy. And then they get sort of trying to put you down, trying to find fault, trying to prove that you're not the real thing. And that's a pain in the ass. So best not to tell people. Tell maybe your teacher. But also, you know, when these things happen, this is like the stream winning, so you still got a sense of self there. But after a while, you know, you start to experience that this is not attainment. This is a disappearing. Change the terminology. You know, from terminology of the world, like this is something you win, you gain, you attain, like a certificate, like a medal. This is not getting medals anymore. It's not being a better human being than other people. It's not pride and arrogance anymore. Your sense of self is vanishing. So that's also one of the reasons why that people go around telling others they're a stream winner, they're a once returner, they're an arahat. They go around saying things like that, That proves that they're not. I always like to go back to the sutras. That's where these two monks, Ajahn Mali, if his brain is working now, can actually tell me which sutra this is. There's two monks who came up to the Buddha, and Ananda was the Buddha's attendant. The first monk said, "One who's fully enlightened never thinks that they are better, worse, or the same as anybody else." And he was just asking a question. Someone who's an arahat, they never think they're better, the worse, or the same. I said, "Yeah, exactly." And somebody else came up and said the same thing. Only two. It doesn't always happen in threes, in this sutta anyway. Another person came up and said exactly the same thing. And then the Buddha turned around to his attendant and said, "Those were two arahats." And he said, "That's how people declare their attainment to me." It's a very beautiful little snapshot. People don't go out to the Buddha and say, "You know, I'm an arahat. I got it today. Please confirm it for me." So sometimes people want confirmation. If you want confirmation, it's not the thing. No, he said. I still remember going, when I went to see Ajahn Tate, there was somebody in front of me. It was a Malaysian girl. And she was a very wealthy, well brought up. And so she thought she had fourth jhana. And I always remember this. She was asking Ajahn Tate to confirm that she had fourth jhana. And said, it was totally peaceful. Couldn't feel anything. It's fourth jhana, wasn't it? And I said, no. And then she said it again. It was fourth jhana, wasn't it? She said, no. And she kept pestering him until she said, "It was fourth jhana, wasn't it?" And after just about 5 minutes, I was watching this. After 5 minutes, he says, "Fourth jhana, ugh." And then she went out and said, "It's been confirmed." he said, "Ugh." People have got such big egos sometimes. Spiritual materialism. So remember, this is not an attainment. This is a letting go, a disappearance. Fetters, things have vanished. But what's left is this huge appreciation of the path of Buddhism, the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path. Huge. Because, you know, it's right there. And it is a fantastic thing. I think I said last week, or somebody reminded me, the very fact that you've stumbled on this path, you know, it's incredible, amazing karma each one of you have got. Just stumbled on this. Of course, you think, that's just Ajahn Brahm just marketing Buddhism. It's not. This is something really powerful and true. And you can feel it's true. You can show it's true. You know, and every time you do the practice in the proper way, it gets more peaceful, more beautiful. Mindfulness increases, your compassion increases, suffering decreases. If you're on the path, you know that that's how it works. That old story of how to overcome doubt, you know, by the simile of the mist. I've said that many times, I'm not going to go into it, it's in even the Good Bad Who Knows book. As long as you're following the stream, it's going downhill. You know you're going to get under the mist soon. As long as you're following more mindfulness, more peace, more joy, you know, the real beautiful joy, not the joy of the five senses, but just inspiration and just renunciation, kindness, then you're going down under the mist. And when you actually get under that mist, under the cloud cover, you can see everything. You know exactly where you are. You've got total confidence because you can actually see with your own eyes of the Dhamma what the truth really is. And if you've got any doubt, check the word of the Buddha. And don't bend that truth of the Buddha. Keep the simple teachings, Eightfold Path, jhanas, mindfulness, knowing the joy, and everything just, wow, this is how the Buddha practiced. And that gives you the goosebumps. You know, that just like when I said he went into that cave 1800 years old. And it's just the path. For 1800 years, monks have been doing this path. For maybe 1,000 years, bhikkhunis were, and now they're doing it again. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's open again. Why it's been closed for such a long time, I don't know, but at least now it's open again. So now that it's here, please follow this path, Eightfold Path. And when these things happen, if there is a sense that this is me, I've achieved something, it's wrong. You've missed it. It has to be a selfless attainment. In other words, things vanishing. After the explosion, lots of things have vanished and disappeared forever. Your sense of self, ego, little by little, that develops. It's like an unravelling. I always call it like an unravelling of the greed, hatred and delusion. Once you've seen there's nothing there, then after a while, all those desires, they've got no ground to grow anymore. They wither and die. 7 lifetimes, 6 lifetimes, I don't know, but you see that they are terminally wounded and they're going to die. You're going to parinibbana. There's no fear about that anymore. There's nothing there. You know that. So what's the point of being afraid of this happening? There's just nothing here, so it's all going to go back to nothing. Thank goodness. So all these teachings come very, very clear. And it's only a matter of time before everything just vanishes. And that's just the path of the Buddha. And so, after a while, you know what to do. It's very simple instructions. Keep it simple. Just meditate. Overcome the 5 hindrances. Get jhana. You know enough about the Buddha, the teachings. And people know too much, but they don't practice enough. And then, big explosion, stream winner, carry on. Soon you vanish, you disappear, and make an end of this. No more weariness. And no more Wednesday night talks. Oh, what a relief. Okay, enough.
Namaying Vairagata Sarakaram Dhammasa
Sadhu, Sadhu,
Arahaṁ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṁ Bhagavantaṁ Parivādhini Suvākkhato Patipano,